The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, these days, there's a lot of talk about apprenticeships and the kind of success you can have without going the academic route. Well, my next guest is the embodiment of that experience. He left school kind of in the middle of his intercert, now the junior cert, and he was glad to see the back of it. But now he's a very successful hotelier who along with his brother Francis, runs two hotels in Kenmare, the Park and the Lansdowne, and the glamping resort at Drumquina. But it was not all plain sailing, as he outlines in his new book, which is called My Name is Jahan. Now, if you think I'm saying it wrong, that's what it says on the cover, J-H-O-N. So, Jahan, or John, good morning and welcome.
You're very observant this morning, Pat.
I wasn't when the first time I saw the cover of the book. I was not. I thought it was John.
No, it's funny. People look at it and they say there's something wrong, but they can't see it. They don't know what it is. They can't put their finger on it, but the name is spelled wrong on purpose.
Now, it's because you were dyslexic, but you didn't know it.
That's true. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, mid-70s, when I was in school, national school, there was no such thing as dyslexia. And it's a stupid name for a problem with words. Like, even for you to pronounce it, it's difficult. And to have a word that explains a condition that has an issue putting letters together. To have an S and a Y within the first three letters of it, it's quite extraordinary. There isn't three or four words in the English language has that. So
you in school were struggling, to say the least.
Yeah, and it was a struggle for which I didn't understand and no one understood. So you were just deemed to be silly or stupid and you sat at the back of the class and you didn't cause any grief and you kind of drifted through and everything was fine. But there wasn't the same emphasis on individual students as there is in today's educational system, I don't think.
Now, it was an American who kind of helped you to understand. Tell me.
And I must get to the bottom of this because in the back of my mind, I have a notion, now you're going to break your sides laughing on this, that his name was Mr. Alphabet. I just have this thing in the back of my head. But anyway, he worked out at Lad Lane in Ballsbridge and Mum brought me to him one Saturday morning and down I went and I sat in front of him and he was a nice, nice American man and he said, John, there's a piece of paper, he says, and a pen, he said, spell bed. And I'm looking at him thinking, sweet Jesus, how do you spell bed? So I started with a B and then it was gone. I couldn't do anything more. And he said, fine. He says, look at the word bed. He said, what's it look like? I said, I don't know. He said, it starts with a B. And he said, a bed, what's at the end of a bed? I said, there's a bedboard at the end. No, he said, that's a kicker at the end, which is what they call it in America. And then he said, that's a D. And then he said, you just have to fill in the little bit in the middle. And then you have a bed. You have a headboard, a flat bit and a kicker. And that's, he made me look at words totally different then. And it's the exact same thing as your very first comment about John on the front of it. People see it, but they don't get it. Whereas I would analyse every word and look at it and I have to break it up to get it. And that would still happen today.
Okay, so you're still doing that, but obviously you cope extremely well in business.
You work twice
and so on.
As fast.
But you also said that your mind works in different ways, that
yes.
In terms of looking, you don't look at spreadsheets, but you can work out the bottom line very quickly.
Yeah, I wouldn't even have to look at the sheet to know how the business is doing. I just know it from the front lobby. But you would look at things differently. And I think when you look at people who have suffered from dyslexia over the years worldwide, a lot of them have been very, very successful because they think twice as quick, I think, and they look at things and they have to work things out that other people don't have to do.
Now, two things happened. One, I mean, there's a lot in the book about your late father and the shop in Stepaside.
Yes. Yeah.
There's one very good story about the bus stop and some
bright spark
in the planning department decided to move the
small
bus stop.
Small little thing that has such an impact on business. Dad had the shop in Milltown, which was well known, the Park Stores and Granny's shop in Milltown, Brennan's. And then he decided it wasn't big enough to cater for all the family. So he bought a shop up in Stepaside. And at that time, Stepaside was out in the sticks. Okay, it's a totally different kettle of fish today. But it was way, way out. And there was an estate built beside it, St. Patrick's, which was mainly built for people who worked in the Dundrum Mental Institution.
All took the bus.
Bus. And they got the bus up and the bus stop was at the front door of the shop. And everyone, guy who came off that bus in the evening at 5 o'clock, came into the shop, bought a bar of chocolate and a newspaper, whatever the case was, and went off home. The bus stop was moved literally 150, 200 yards up the road and all that business walked away. And that was a huge, huge loss to the shop. Small little thing that no one even considered would have an impact.
Now that informs your approach to business today. I know I'm jumping around a bit, but that is the point about the business in the park or Drumquina or the new Lansdowne. it's about attention to detail.
It is, and it's about being aware of what's available in the marketplace, because I'm a strong believer in that. We do, I'm at your service now, it's gas, because when you go into a place, they all decide they'll do a carvery lunch because the place down the road is offering a carvery lunch. Like, it's madness, because now you have two places offering the same thing. You should always offer something a little bit different that gives you a bit of a niche, no more than this channel, okay, gives you a niche, and then that creates a market on its own. And if you're good at that niche, that market, you protect yourself within it. And I'd be very conscious of that always in business.
The lessons in business, though, that you learned from your father, for instance, and he may have been, appeared to you like a harsh taskmaster, yeah. Like the time you started to manufacture Christmas logs
for from Larch Hill. Dad got sick. He'd emphysema and chronic bronchitis for 17 years, but it hit him literally on a Saturday evening at 3 o'clock in the shop and collapsed behind the counter. But he kept the account which we had for deliveries when we sold the shop for the Catholic Boy Scouts, which had their big headquarters in Larch Hill. And then we'd go up every Saturday with the groceries for them. And then coming up to Christmas, he said, why don't you get a few logs? He said, we'll make Christmas logs. So I said, fine.
For
the centre of the table. So we got it, and we had to get a drill, and he'd Black and Decker. I remember it all. They always burnt out. They're probably much better nowadays, but they were a disaster back then. We'd go through 3 or 4 drills every Christmas. And then you got your half inch, and you got your 6-inch taper white candle, or your red candle, and you got your ivy, and you got your gun for stapling it on. You got your spray, which was always expensive and hard to get. That ran out of H. Williams.
The snow spray.
The snow spray that walked out the door, yeah. And then you had to be careful that you wouldn't spray them too much. So then you had to line all the 13 of them up. And we used to get Johnston Mooney and O'Brien bread trays, which were beautiful. They held 13 loaves of bread, and they were good size. And we used to get them, and it would line them all up in that, and then spray them all over. And then Dad would put me in the car, and then we'd drive around the estates of Dunemer and Ballally and Clannard, and we'd sell them door to door at Christmas.
And you made a fortune.
I wouldn't say a fortune, but it was a very good exercise. It was a very good exercise.
And he had you costing everything down to the little staples.
Yeah, but 100%. And then there was I didn't realise the bays underneath was another thing we had to buy. And all these things added up, and he'd be killing me if I didn't get the prices right on the whole thing. But it was a very, very good lesson, because you always wanted to sell the smallest log first. Because there was no problem going to be selling the big one, so you'll sell that down the road, no trouble. But you didn't want to be left with the bad one, the runt or the litter as such, okay? So you always tried to get that out of the way.
Yeah. Now, you were living, of course, in Dublin, but then because of your father's illness and the foul air in Dublin at the time, smog and chimneys. The fog and all the rest of it, off you went to Sligo.
Correct.
And you have great time for what that did for you in terms of your perception of your fellow man.
Yeah, no, that is quite true. When we were in Dublin, I went to a city school here in the middle of town, and the ethos of it was totally different. And you were isolated from your colleagues and students in the school, because they went all over the city.
Yeah, this was CUS, and it was an academic school, and people went to it to achieve excellence.
They taught Latin, that's all you need to know, right? Okay. Not for me. And they played cricket, as Francis tells many a time. But anyway, that aside, you were isolated. There was no community in the school after hours, because they were from all over the city. So we went to Sligo, and then there was a debate over where to go to school in Sligo, and it was decided I'd go out to Ballestair. And I was the only person actually in Sligo who went out to Ballestair at that time, which was 6 miles outside the town. But it was a totally different culture, and it was a farming culture, it was a rural culture, and it was a bit of crack, and it was co-ed, which helped as well. But it was a different approach to teaching, and there was a total different feel in the whole school.
There's no point in educating a lad who's going to be working his life on the farm. There's no point in teaching him Latin.
No, absolutely. There's no point teaching me Latin in Leeson Street either, but anyway, no. Both exercises
now,
were
futile. Now, you come to the Intercert you're doing, which is now the Junior Cert, or maybe, I don't know whether it's going to exist anymore, but anyway, 9 subjects you were put down for. How many papers did you take?
I did 5.
And walked out.
On Friday. I walked out, and at that time I was working on a vegetable truck on Saturdays, and on the Friday I rang Burke's in Sligo, and I said, listen, any chance of getting a full time job? And they said, fine, start Monday morning. So I started on Monday morning on a Hino 155, I think it was, a truck. We used to go to Ballina, and I couldn't sit at the window because the seat was too big. I had to sit in the middle because there was a smaller seat in the middle of the cab, and off we went. And that was a great exercise. That was a great learning curve.
But what did your mammy say when you said, I'm leaving
something?
School,
you know, when I'm writing the book, I'm thinking, if that was my son, I'd be out of my mind, right? But she wasn't, because she was probably at that stage, she was worn to a thread. There was no point working on me anymore. No, they accepted it. Once I got a job, they were quite happy with that. It was funny, a different time, I suppose, than today. And certainly the essence of the book in school and third level college at the moment and society's opinion of that was very different back then. So leaving and going into a job like that, she probably was heartbroken, but she never showed it to me.
Yeah. And of course, it hasn't inhibited your success as a hotelier. Although, as I learned from the book, it hasn't been all plain sailing. I mean, the Park Hotel, that wonderful, the grand old lady of Kenmare, was almost gone from you.
Yeah, very close to it. But you see, again, all those lessons come back in later life. And the better the foundation, the better the house in the long term. And the exact same thing goes for business. So when we went into difficult times, when we built apartments, like there's a wonderful thesis to be done on the amount of developers who went wallop because they went into hotels and the number of hoteliers who went wallop because they went into development. Okay, it's a wonderful story because there's loads of cases. Thankfully, we were both, but we didn't fall foul of either. But it was you pull on all those strings when the hard times come, and I suppose experience will get you out of it. But the most important thing is that you keep talking, keep going.
And keep talking to the banks.
Yes, 100%.
Having an angel investor is also... Yeah. But that came... That was historical as well, because your angel investor was well acquainted with your product.
He was indeed, yeah. And I had never thought of him at all, Fergal Nocton. I phoned him. He phoned me from Australia one day, and I said to him, God, he's my man. Why don't I talk to him? So we came to Kenmare the next day. He'd bought an apartment office previously. And he came, we sat down, we had a chat. We hammered out a deal, which was very, very simple. And I went into the bank on the Monday morning. I said, if I give you a cheque for X, I said, will you tear up the file? And they said, we'll take your arm with it. We'd be thrilled. So out we went.
Job done, and the Park survives and prospers.
And I don't blame the bank. I don't hold a grudge against the bank. I think there was a win-win for everyone. But if I borrow €100 off you and don't give it back to you, you won't be happy. Bank is the same.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a two-way street.
Now, you describe yourself as a man not bearing grudges. If I was in your shoes, I might be bearing a grudge against Sean Dunn. You took over the eminent hotels of Jury's and the Barclay Court in Bulls Bridge and ran them for Sean Dunn as D4 Hotels. But it did not end well.
It didn't end well, but it was a great experience. Okay, so you're sitting, put it in context, okay? So you're sitting in Kenmare. You get a phone call from a guy who has three hotels with 606 bedrooms in Bulls Bridge. And he says, would you like to run them? Now, what do you do? Say no.
No. It's a wonderful, you say yes, yes, yes.
You say a wonderful opportunity. Get out and do it. So up we came to Dublin, the country crew on a bus, and we got stuck in. And it was amazing because no one expected those hotels to be reopened. When Doyle's were selling it, they never in their wildest dreams expected them to be opened. Sean himself didn't expect it to be open when he bought it. Everyone expected it to be demolished immediately. But because it was 2008, there was a bit of a black cloud coming on the horizon. It hadn't arrived quite at that time. And Dublin was on a high. It was absolutely flying. And we put in a very simple business plan, a very interesting business plan, because we took on no F&B services. We brought in Charlie Chalk. We brought in various different suppliers to run
the
different
So I rented the room, and it was a standard charge,
89 euros.
89 Correct. Euros for the room, double, end single, whatever, end of. Yeah. And if I wanted my breakfast, I bought it.
Correct. And the accommodation, we only had 33 staff in the hotel because the accommodation was rented out to Celtic Linen, who supplied the linen and the people to dress the room every day, service the room. Food and beverage was looked after from various different operators, FX Buckley and so on. So all we had to do was get people into beds, and then all the other service providers were happy because the business was going to come back through them. So we opened, and it was slow at the start. The first month wasn't easy, and then it started to turn, and by the third month we were in good space.
And then Sean decided he didn't want you there anymore.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, something like that anyway. Yeah.
I won't go into the story of the Nortel machine because it's in the book, and I think I don't want to spoil it. It's a good story. But suffice to say, you walked away from Sean Dunn and you do not bear him a grudge, it would appear.
I don't bear him a grudge. Business is business, and he was in a position where he felt he needed to run the hotels himself, and that was fine. We got in, we got out, we did fine out of it, and I would say the experience I got out of it was probably more than the financial kickback that I got out of it. But I would, if I got the opportunity again tomorrow, I'd do it. Yeah. Like, I go back to my first point. If you're sitting in Kenmare and you're offered 606 bedrooms in the middle of Bulls Bridge, do you take it?
And you'd still do it again. You'd say yes again. I mentioned at the beginning that you run the glamping in Drumquin, and it's a great wedding venue as well. But you bought that, and there's a very tortuous story about how you finally ended up with that. Yeah. And again, it's about being open and talking to the banks and keeping things going.
Yeah.
But you bought that while you're being treated for cancer.
No, I bought it the day I was diagnosed with cancer. I was diagnosed. I went to see Mary Cahill, who's our consultant in Cork, and she told us the news at 11 o'clock on the morning, 16th of March 2011, that I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I'm looking at her thinking, listen, now that's as good as the Latin in Leeson Street. Now that was okay. It meant nothing to me. And she said, you're at stage four, which equally meant nothing to me because I didn't know what that meant. So we had a chat about it, and poor old Gwen was with me, my wife, and she was in bits, needless to say. She went back to Kenmare. I went back to Tipperary filming because we were in the middle of At Your Service scene at the time. And then at 5 o'clock that afternoon, the phone rang and it was Paul Collins from CBRE. And he said, John, he said, the bank have accepted your deal. They want to deal. I said, fantastic. So I rang Gwen back and I said, no, Gwen, I said, I have good news. No, John, she says, there can't be good news today. I said, there is. I said, we're after buying Drumquin. So I won't tell you the reply.
Anyway, suffice to say that your treatment was very successful. Yeah. I mean, it's an ongoing thing. You don't have it now.
I do have it. I always have it. And it is treatable, and when you get treated, it knocks it back for a period of time.
Okay, so it goes into remission,
and it'll come back again. So eventually, I'll have some sort of a transfusion of blood or bone marrow or something like that, and that stem cell, and that might hit it on the head for good. But anyway, that's all in the future.
Now, there's all sorts of yarns in it about inviting the Queen to Kenmare. Won't even go there again. There's so much to enjoy in the book. But I mean, you've had your misadventures. I mean, you were a manufacturer of furniture at one point.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the one before that, okay? We did three-legged stools, all right, which were in the shape of a shamrock with about 18 inches, 2 foot off the ground, 24 inches there, thereabouts. Anyway, and we did them, and Francis got a contract with the duty-free in Shannon. So we put them all in jiffy bags, the padded bags, so they'd be easy to carry when you're travelling, and we got into the duty-free, and I brought down 600 of them. And they were made out of Canadian pine, a yellow pine, and they were really, really nice, lovely shamrock. Brought them down, and we didn't sell one.
Not one.
No, because stools in America means a totally different thing than what it does here. So the Americans were looking at these three-legged stools and say, no, not for me.
Anyway.
So we went into the furniture as well.
Yeah, but again, lessons learned. And that's what comes through again and again in the book, that sometimes things go wrong. Like you blew a lot of money designing the sauna that didn't get built in preparation for building the sauna, the spa that did get built.
Yeah, but you see, you don't get things right if you don't get things wrong. So all of those things add up. And I think that's the thing about the book from a business point of view is to be sure that you just keep going and that you step back and you look at your business with a fresh set of eyes every now and again just to make sure you're on the right track. But you just have to keep your shoulders to the wheel. And if you are finished, you are finished.
That's it.
If you think you're finished.
If you think you're finished,
you're finished. You're finished. Yeah, exactly.
Well, the book is called My Name is John. An Atypical Story of Success. It's written by John Brennan. It's published by Gill Books. I hope it will be available, by the way, as an audiobook in time.
We're working on it.
Yeah, because for people with dyslexia, they might find it a challenge to read the book in print. It'd be nice for them to...
There's very few words with more than five letters in it now.
Yeah. All right. John Brennan, My Name is John, published by Gill Books in all good bookshops. John, thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning.